I think without further ado, Nico is going to start. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, yesterday I thought I was unlucky that I only had a ticket for the first bus. So luck can change. All right. So thanks, Bridget, for reminding me that there are actually three different types of problems that we are meant to discuss. I wasn't actually sure when I looked at the program how much overlap there is between the different themes. I mean, heterogeneity seems to be the thing that appears under virtually every topic. I'm actually not going to exactly address the questions that you posed there, and if you insist, maybe we can talk about this at the end. Sort of picked out a few things that I thought were important, and still issues, old issues, still issues, which are listed here. So I'm going to talk about, degrees of right and wrong. Actually, Richard talked about this a little yesterday. It's sort of, I think the number that he had was 70% right and so on. So there's obviously a continuum of rights and wrongs. Then ways to increase reliability. I wasn't sure what Richard was going to talk about, but so he had mentioned a couple of things. I'm going to talk about this also a little bit. Detecting problems, obviously, is important. Different types of heterogeneity leads us into what Fred's then going to talk about with more theory. And still Fred and maximum likelihood classification, and then I come back with some more practical implementations of classification, just ideas, really, nothing that actually has been published. So if it's not totally refined or so, then please excuse me, but it's sort of more discussion of ideas. And Fred will finish with heterogeneity of continuously changing molecules. So, degrees of right and wrong. You'll see in some of these cases, in my little write-up, it said I should have case studies. I will talk about successes of other people and then more problematic cases that came out of my own lab just to avoid assassination afterwards. just as a sort of philosophical. So we had this already up yesterday. This is just one example out of several. Very beautiful high-resolution work of icosahedral viruses. And so I thought I'll mention a few examples where we think the structure is largely correct. Okay, so when you get to near-atomic resolution, you can build atomic models. And, of course, that is a very good way of verifying your structure. I'm not saying that the interpretation of your structure is necessarily correct, so you can still make mistakes in building a model into it. But the fact that you can trace the chain, that you can see side chains and so on, all would argue that overall this structure is correct, that there are no big mistakes. One thing that I found interesting sort of in discussing with high resolution with people is that I think I talked to Paul Penchik yesterday, who thought that whether you get high resolution or not is actually a sort of matter of luck. That depends on how well your particles behaved. And it occurred to me that this is actually a problem that is now similar to what the X-ray crystal lockers have. It depends on the order of your sample, which I think is a great situation, because now we can worry, maybe at least in some cases, more about the getting good samples than the image processing. So this work and other work from other labs and our lab sort of established that you can get there if you have a good sample, which is a really important thing to know. Another image that I think Tom had up there, the 20S proteasome. So in this case, you are not at near atomic resolution, so between 6 and 8 angstroms, but you see secondary structure, little sausages here and there, And because there's an X-ray structure that you can dock into it, you can verify that these sausages are actually corresponding to secondary structure. And I think that's an important part here, because just because you see sausage-like density doesn't mean that you have the correct secondary structure. I'm going to come back to this in a moment, but I think to ultimately decide that this is correct, you either have solved it before. You know, there are other people, other labs that that looked at the proteasome, obviously, so you know that overall the structure is correct. Anyway, if you don't know, but you get this, but you have an X-ray structure that can dock into it, that would be, again, a very good way of verifying your structure. Of course, again, to many people, this is a resolution that, you'll not get, and we'll talk about this more. Just going further down in symmetry, so now here we have an asymmetric particle, and again, this was something that came up yesterday. So you have an X-ray model that interprets the density and therefore verifies the reconstruction. And of course, with a ribosome, it's not the first time somebody has calculated a reconstruction of the ribosome, so the overall structure has already been known. And so even if you don't have an X-ray model or other atomic model to dock into, you know, this sample has been studied many times before, and you get a sort of overall same shape, I think you can be certain that overall the structure is correct. So there's no gross mistakes.
Gross mistake.
It's a 70, I guess I was still stuck with the bacterial work a long time ago.
So the ribosome field is a 30 plus 50 equals 70.
Yeah. No, somehow I saw, so this is the bacterial, and I was thinking, sorry, that you were working on the eukaryotic. Sorry.
We are.
But this is. Yeah. Shall I correct you? Yeah. All right. Okay. So now. I come to maybe something that's more typical to what people often obtain, a calcium ion channel, L-type calcium channel, so that's from skeletal muscle, a sample that we worked on a few years ago, worked by Matthias Wolf, a graduate student in my lab, who's now with Steve Harrison. And the structure that we obtained is at about 23 angstroms, and there's no X-ray structure that we can compare it with, and therefore the question arises, is this overall correct or not? And so what did we do to reassure ourselves that this is not totally wrong? Well, the first thing was that we looked at negative stain and obtained a three-dimensional structure with the angular reconstitution method, which is very risky because, especially when you don't have symmetry, the angular assignment of these class averages can go wrong. Okay, so, but we repeated this with another data set collected in ICE without using this as a model to assign the angles here and obtained the same result. So that it told us at the time that this is probably overall correct. But I agree with Richard when he says that, the tilt test would have been a good thing to do. So we didn't do this. So I'm open to criticism, and that's why I'm showing this. This is how we proceeded at the time. One thing that I would like to point out is that this reconstruction didn't have any correction for the Constant transfer function. And what you get when you don't correct for the Constant transfer function is often a hollow appearance of your structure, which is something that I would say is an artifact and therefore an error in your in your structure. I just talked to somebody about correcting for the CTF. There are different ways of doing this. Some people phase flip their images, and then this is all they do for the CTF correction. And others do phase flip plus an amplitude correction. This sort of thing here you may see when you don't correct for the amplitude at low resolution, because the CTF attenuates your signal significantly at low resolution. And so it acts a bit like a high-pass filter, and this is what it would get when your high-pass filter is structured, especially a globular structure like this. You will get a hole in the middle. So if this is probably one should always correct for the CTF all the way, including amplitudes and phases. But if you see a hole in your structure like this and you're not so sure about the CTF, that might be something that was generated by you know, wrongly calculating or correcting for the CTF. Yes, so maybe in the future you don't need to do anything anymore, but right now I think this is something that people often don't realize. Also, when sometimes you see in the literature the argument that you don't need to correct for the CTF because you only consider data out to the first zero. But again, that would mean that you didn't correct for the amplitudes, and you end up with something like this. So the hole went away after correcting for the CTF, as you can see here. Yeah.
You have this problem with the helical thing, too, where you have the equator, and as it approaches the origin, the CTF goes to zero, so you can't divide by zero. So what do you do when you, as you get really, because that's really important, that's the lowest resolution term, is as you get right next to the origin.
Yeah.
Well,
first of all, you don't go to zero at low resolution. You go to something like 7% or 10%. And when you look at the signal or the you know the structure factors, remember Richard's plot yesterday, the signal at low resolution is actually very strong. And therefore, 10% is still substantial. And so I think the problem isn't so much that there isn't sufficient signal at low resolution. It's more that at low resolution, other things are happening, like you get inelastic scattering that may contribute to your contrast, and it's difficult to account for that and decide what exactly you should divide by, say, by 0.1 or 0.07 or so. I remember that Bettina Böttcher, when she worked on hepatitis B virus, came up or had this problem of correcting for the low resolution terms. Because she called it a fudge factor, because she could get full viruses that looked like they had some genome in there, and empty viruses. I think maybe Sarah here nods. So this is something that, for example, virus people know very well, and so it is something that's, yeah.
Maybe a distraction, but I would have said it just the opposite.
Yeah. Okay, but at least we can agree that.
Let it be that David and I are right.
Yeah. That's always the basic assumption, but. but at least we all agree that the inelastic scattering, if you don't subtract it with an energy filter, contributes in some way to the low resolution contrast.
But it cancels the amplitude contrast. It actually decreases the amount of contrast.
Okay.
But it increases the phase contrast.
Yeah.
Therefore, you might be better.
Well, inelastic scattering doesn't increase the phase contrast.
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-oh. Sorry, Nico, you should look up again.
And carry on.
Yes. Yeah, I think that it's probably useful to discuss this a little later.
Yes.
I actually have some images of inelastically scattered viruses that look like a dark field image, so it would agree with what you say.
We'll actually be touching on it in the Tuesday panel discussion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay. Should I prepare those images for? All right. So we then went on and tried to determine the location of some of the subunits. This is a 5-subunit assembly, actually, this ion channel, using antibodies. And, you know, we had a bunch of images that showed an antibody bound to a channel. It seemed to, this one against the alpha 2 subunit seemed to consistently bind to this little tail of the structure. And then another one here against the beta subunit seemed to consistently bind to this little, this extension on this side of the channel. I mean, this is all blobology, obviously, but, you know, these experiments further increased our confidence that this is, the structure isn't totally wrong, but that there is something that corresponds to reality. You know, otherwise you wouldn't have gotten this consistent labeling if the structure was, or the interpretation of the labels could not have been fit together with this reconstruction. And so basically we think the structure is overall correct, although, you know, further interpretation to a higher resolution we weren't able to do.
Is this your class average or your particle?
What, these here?
That's your class average?
Oh, yeah, here at the end. No, this is all particles. You mean because this one looks a little better than the rest? Yeah, it might be a little shinier, yes. No, actually, you're right. This here is an average of these. It's a long time ago, but you're right. These two here, that's why there's actually a little square around here. Mm-hmm. So too good to be true. So this is a slide that I showed in the past, and so it's a bit like what Richard said yesterday. There are a bunch of things that some of you might already have seen before. So when Matthias worked on the ion channel, at some point he was quite excited because the Fourier-Shah correlation showed a 9.2 angstrom signal. So this would be the 0.5 criterion, or, you know, it's a fairly steep fall off, so not so different for the 0.14 criterion. But, you know, when you look at the structure, it does show, especially here in this membrane domain, a lot of detail that one, if one really wanted to, could even interpret as secondary structure. You know, I mean, sort of the little sausages and so on. At the time, there's actually a little bit more known about the structure of the ion channel than I told you. The channel is expected to look a little like the X-ray structures of some other ion channels, you know, potassium channels, for example. And so one can verify this, but, you know, I don't think one even needs to go there. This is a structure that doesn't look like it is really resolved at 9.2 angstrom, although it has sort of detail that looks like it's at that level. And so the point I wanted to make, and also said with the proteasome, just because you have sausage-like density doesn't mean that you see alpha helices. This could also be a case of over-refinement, which I'm going to describe to you in a minute. Something that I think people are still sometimes ignoring, that this can happen. And I don't think that if you have a refinement scheme that includes a classification step, that you would avoid this. So still a problem, I think. And so remember, I was starting with degrees of right and wrong. So at low resolution, this is obviously still a structure that I just told you I think is correct. But at high resolution, this is a structure that is probably entirely incorrect. And so, you know, that's why I think there are degrees of right and wrong, as Richard mentioned. So why do we get this? Again, something that I showed before. The way most of us measure the Fourier correlation is we have some refinement cycle where we align our particles against a reference, and then the new alignment gives us a better reference through averaging, and we go around this many times. And the Fourier correlation is measured by dividing the data set in two halves and calculating two averages from each half of the data, and then you evaluate the agreement between these two halves using the Fourier correlation. And it, you know, starts at one and then falls off to some at some rate. And so if you align noise, pure noise images against the reference, and then average the aligned noise images, you do get back your reference. I mean, it's something that people have known for ages. The reproduction of your reference is the better, the more images you put into this alignment. So if you look back at this scheme here, because all the data was aligned against a single reference, these two averages are biased to agree with each other, simply because of this effect that I just showed you. And so agreement here means better Fourier correlation, and therefore this curve can show a beautiful correlation indicating a nice resolution, but actually it's mainly the noise that you aligned to agree all with the reference. So that's something that I think it's very tempting, I think, to trust this curve. And also when people adjust their parameters of whatever program they're using, they might find that this curve can be improved. For example, people sometimes apply a negative B factor to their raw images to boost the high-resolution signal and then see that the curve improves. And so they think they've done something good, but actually the structure gets worse because all it does is over-refine the high-resolution signal. So I think not everybody in the room agrees with my assessment here, but I think this is something that still happens frequently.
Nico, is that's from noise that FSC is showing there?
No, that's just a random plot. I mean, this here is the actual FSC for the structure. One hallmark of this behavior is that the Fourier correlation creeps up as you increase more and more data. So this was probably refined at something like 9 angstroms. And when it is refined at 8 angstroms, this curve probably would have been even better. Whereas when it was refined at 10 angstroms, the curve was worse. So a strong dependence of the Fourier correlation on how much data you include in your refinement is an indication of this kind of behavior.
Where's the Nyquist? Is it right that they have?
I think we had 3.5 angstroms, so yes, it's sort of right here.
I see.
Yeah.
Nico, is this a case where you align your particles to a common reference, or
yeah.
Did you have two independent references?
No.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean.
So this is exactly an example of what you're doing.
Yeah, that's exactly an example of what I was. And I think most people still do this. Anybody here who evaluates Fourier correlations between data sets that never saw each other?
We do it, but we never show it.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't you show it?
I'd point out one other thing about what you just said, though.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you add more data, the goal of adding more data is to get the higher resolution.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, there are certain, you know, once you have a little more experience, there are sort of a certain behavior like this that could give it away. But it's nothing that one could probably write down or even put into an algorithm that always tells you that this is going on.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Do you treat entirely different
data I do something else. So this is the data weighting that I'm going to describe in a minute.
I would encourage us all, even ourselves, we don't do it either.
Yeah.
I think that this low-level threshold of 0.14 is more justifiable.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think I agree with the arguments that Richard and Peter made in their paper. But I think in many practical cases, that leads to a resolution that obviously is wrong. And the reason is that probably you have an over-optimistic Fourier-Shaw correlation, and therefore an 0.5 criterion brings you back to reality. But there is a more, in my mind, a reason for this bad behavior of the Fourier-Shaw correlation, and that's this overfitting, and it would be better to avoid that in the first place. I mean, I agree with you. You can sort of get a more reliable Fourier-Shaw correlation if you separate the two halves of the data entirely, but there's an underlying problem. And so, again, something that I showed in the past, a few years ago, I started investigating I started investigating the behavior of this over-refinement of noise. And as I told you, one thing that I think many of us know is that when you apply a negative B factor to your images, you can almost arbitrarily increase your Fourier-Shaw correlation. Okay, so it has something to do, this behavior has something to do with the weighting of your data in reciprocal space. I generated a data set here. It's, what all of us do are trying to debug methods. Something computer generated. This is just two intersecting cubes. I added a bunch of noise and also applied a CTF and then generated projections with random orientations and some displacement. And I had a data set of 30,000 particles. And then I refined the data set and got, I really tried to refine it as much as I could and got these different Fourier-Shaw correlation curves out when I used different kinds of similarity measures. Okay, so I guess the most common is sort of a straight correlation coefficient between the reference and the images. That you're trying to maximize. An older version of Freeline used something else, a phase residual, where you just compare the phases of the reference and the images and minimize that. That is something that I just borrowed from the 2D crystal work that I used to do. And then there's something that I call a weighted correlation coefficient, that is where the correlation coefficient is weighted in resolution zones according to some signal-to-noise measure of the data. And not so important how exactly that happens, but these are the different results. So you get according to the Fourier-Shaw correlation, a very nice reconstruction for both the phase residual and the linear correlation coefficient. Both of these curves would already raised suspicion, I think, with everybody who's done this a few times. It goes up to, basically the Nyquist. That's sort of where we cut it off. Whereas the red curve with the weighted correlation coefficient also still has a suspicious behavior because it doesn't reach zero. It goes to this point and then also drops to zero. So clearly none of these curves are entirely trustworthy. But the red curve is still quite a bit, more realistic than the other two curves, especially when you compare it to the true resolution that I can calculate, of course, because I have this data is generated on a computer, and I can compare the refined reconstructions here with the original structure. And so this is those are the true resolution curves. And here, although, here it looked like the red curve was the worst, corresponding to the worst reconstruction, it actually corresponds to the best reconstruction. And then these are successively worse correlation coefficient and phase residual. And when you compare the true curve with the estimated curve from the Fourier correlation of the two half sets, it agrees pretty well out to a point like this, and then there's still some artifact here in the estimated Fourier correlation. So data weighting does two things. It makes the Fourier correlation a little more reliable, although not entirely reliable. It deviates especially in a place where the signal is very weak. You know, it gets weaker towards higher resolution. But it also improves the structure, the true detail. And that's why I think just dealing with the problem by dividing the data in two halves and that never see each other fixes one of them, the curve, but it doesn't fix the overfitting problem. And so I think a more sensible weighting of the signal is a good thing. Yeah, that's for the alignment, not for reconstruction or anything. Okay, so this is something that is built into Freeline. This is going on with other ways of making things a little more reliable. I saw that Bridges' lab actually had used, in a more systematic manner, this program that we published 2 years ago, so R measure, that reads in a reconstruction and asks you for the pixel size, and then is trying to estimate the resolution just based on the reconstruction itself. So there's no division of data in two halves or so, and it's an idea that, in theory, works. Because there are a number of tests or test structures, also from the literature, where the resolution estimation by R measure agrees with the Fourier correlation. There are other structures where it doesn't agree, and then one has to ask, is the program failing, or is the person who did the structure overestimating his or her resolution? This here was, I guess, the most systematic investigation of structure of resolution dependence on various parameters like microscope parameters, number of particles in the data set. And I guess what Scott found out is that R measure indicates the same resolution up to a point, but then sort of tails off where the Fourier correlation continues in a way that Steve described, right? That's sort of more or less what you described. Sort of continues in a sort of linear fashion as you add more particles. Of course, the overall structure here is correct. Okay, we know the overall structure of the of Gros-Yale, and so it's more the question of, is it correct at high resolution? The sentence that stuck out for me in this publication here was that the resolution reported by R measure was more consistent with the details observed in the reconstructions. Now, this is, of course, a very subjective statement. I should say R measure is, because Tom mentioned it yesterday, it is a somewhat temperamental program, one that is not 100% reliable. And I'm not sure if it is suitable in its current form to just blindly submit your structure and get back a resolution. I think it is not robust enough to be such a tool. it can be probably made more robust by considering different pathological cases. It fails, in my experience, especially when you have things like the structure that I just showed you. It wouldn't estimate this here correctly, partly because the masking that is done inside the program may have trouble finding a proper outline of the molecule. But it's, on the other hand, I think I know other people who are using it. I think Tom told me that he's using it, people in Eva Nogales' lab, I think, have used it.
Could you explain the principle?
Oh, okay. The principle is that when you think of your particle sitting in a box, it's a bit like a unit cell for X-ray crystallographers. Your particle will not fit the entire volume of your box. And therefore, if you only had the particle there, no noise, you would find in your Fourier transformation that adjacent Fourier pixels correlate with each other to some degree, because the particle is smaller than basically you're oversampling with a larger box, a box that is larger than your particle. And so there's a correlation that is produced by the signal between neighboring Fourier pixels. The noise, if it is spread throughout the cube, the box that your particle sits in, will also generate a Fourier signal, but one that, if it is truly spread across your entire box, would not be correlated. Now, if you have most people mask their structure, and so the noise is not spreading throughout the box, but it's sort of surrounding the molecule. But it still has a different correlation than the signal. And so when you characterize these two types of correlation, you find that their magnitude changes as you go to higher resolution. The correlation of the signal, the correlation of the noise, the Fourier neighbor correlation of the signal and noise, they change towards higher resolution. And at some point, it's just the noise term that produces correlation. And so that was something I thought can be used to characterize a structure. But you need to accurately mask your structure to say this is the signal here and outside of it is noise. And so that's one of the weaknesses of this approach. Okay, so some other structures where I tested this on, like an older structure of the 70S. And here, Ryanin receptor. And you see, the curves that our measure produces are good beyond a certain resolution of something like maybe 20 angstroms or so, but do something crazy at low resolution. And that has to do with the strong influence of the molecular envelope there. So structures don't go to higher resolution may not be, or maybe we cannot evaluate with our measure, although there might be some things we can do there. But in its current form, our measure wouldn't be good to evaluate something that doesn't go beyond 20 angstroms. It's more sort of to detect high resolution information. Okay, so coming back to degrees of right and wrong. Before that, we had how to avoid right and how to avoid wrong. So I was describing how we worried a little about the overall correctness of this reconstruction of the ion channel, and that this is a difficult thing to do. And even now, I would, if somebody really challenged this, I probably wouldn't be able to totally back it up. I mean, there were certain things that we did to try to be correct. But, in the literature, there are other reconstructions of this very same channel, but prepared differently. So, different detergent, different way of preparing the grids and so on. Sometimes there were also lipid present. Other times there was no lipid present. And so all of these things may have led to the differences in the reconstructions that you can see here. I mean, this wasn't even a true reconstruction. It's sort of just guessing the 3D structure from these class averages. But overall, you could invoke something like different sample preparation. Sometimes people also talk about large conformational changes and so on that justify big differences between structures that people have determined. But I would say it's also possible that some of these reconstructions are entirely wrong. And therefore, I brought it up here as an example of a possible case where some of these structures are wrong. Another one here is, so we weren't involved in any of these structures, the IP3 receptor. Again, there's a bunch of different structures that have come out 2002, 3, and 4, and they look substantially different. And you can argue these are partly due to conformational differences between the molecules. But, you know, one also has to ask, are all of these reliable structures? So here's an example, again, from our own lab, the spliceosome, C-complex spliceosome. This is the mammalian complex that we have been working on with Melissa Moore at Brandeis. And so this just shows a prep that we had in 2002, negatively stained, and we proceeded the usual way with the angular reconstitution methods. And so here's the 3D structure. Here are reprojections of the, here are class averages. Here are reprojections of the structure. Here are raw particles. And so this is the sort of thing that Tom Wall said you should show in order to demonstrate that your reconstruction is correct. But we weren't sure at the time that this reconstruction is correct. There was no, unlike the ribosome where people have determined the structure over and over again, this was sort of the first time that somebody looked at the structure. And so we also did the random conical tilt procedure where you just collect tilt pairs, identify the particles, and then using the untilted particles, calculate class averages, and then for each class you can calculate reconstructions. And you can then, if you think they are sufficiently identical, merge them. So the spliceosome is extremely heterogeneous, and therefore, you know, these reconstructions always have some difference. And so you have to sort of decide at what point you call this the same or different as a subjective decision, although I guess one could make it more objective by looking at correlation coefficients between them. But anyway, so you merge some of these structures to achieve a more fully sampled data set because these structures may be different because of heterogeneity, but they're also different because of slightly different angles of the view. And so we had a bunch of different ones here that came out of this random conical tilt, and some of them we combined. And so then we got this structure, and this is the one that we got from the earlier work where we didn't tilt. And you can see there are similarities between the two, but there are also differences. In particular, there's this apparent mirror symmetry here of this reconstruction. I mean, it's not exactly a mirror, but compared to this one, you can see that the mirror is absent here. And in the end, we decided that this must have been, you know, an artifact of the way we assigned the orientations and something that we would not have detected if we hadn't done the random conical tilt procedure as well. And so, you know, the structure that got published in the end is this one. Of course, because it has tilted tilt information in there, or images from tilted specimens as well as untilted, we haven't done exactly the test that Richard was talking about, but at least there's some more certainty about the angular assignment of different particles, and therefore more confidence in this structure. So I think that one of the lessons from both what Richard said yesterday and also this here is that when you start work on an entirely new particle that nobody has ever looked at before, and therefore you don't really know what an overall correct structure should look like, really means that you have to collect tilt data, either to get a first structure using the orthogonal tilt reconstruction technique or random conical tilt reconstruction technique, or to verify your structure afterwards using the freehand difference technique that Richard mentioned. In fact, this is yeah.
I fully agree with that. Just to carry that out, mm-hmm. that it's not the angular reconstitution is right, and you see deformation because you have tilt.
Yeah, no idea. In fact, yes, no, it's, you know, it's this one has a different problem in that you get a sort of an elongation in one direction when you have preferred orientations. And also, because of the preferred orientations, the particle tends to interact with the carbon film in a particular manner. And I think from the ribosome work, we know very well that this can cause distortions in the molecule. Yeah, then you get something that looks much more similar to this.
But
so we've done that.
But those distortions and the stretching, and, you know, or does it look much too much like the random?
So this part has an additional problem of heterogeneity. Okay, so you sort of have to deal with that as well, and that's, you know, the random conical tilt being something that uses class averages sort of got around this a little. But in principle, yes, you can do this.
Nico.
Yeah.
Nico, I just want to point out, because you have a slide just before where you show the consistency between
this
the projections,
here.
The projections, yeah, and the reprojections.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to point out again that it has nothing to do with the validation of the reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
Shows the self-consistency of the program system,
yeah,
and nothing more.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you get the angle assignments are correct and self-consistent, but it should not be used. It has nothing to do with the validity of the reconstruction. It should never be used.
So you're saying this doesn't prove anything?
It doesn't prove anything.
Yeah. So
because you stuck the projection at this particular plane, and afterwards you see, there's my projection again.
Yeah. Well, in
Fourier space, you immediately see it doesn't make
any sense. I agree with you 50%. Yes.
That's not enough.
Because at this point, these are not just the reading out the data that you put in to calculate reconstruction. It's a sort of a merged data set where you have, so it's a little more than that. And so, I agree with you here that this isn't a proof, but is a minimum requirement.
Yeah.
So. So you would basically try to, you remove all the particles that went into this class average,
yeah, that
then calculated this,
exactly,
and then see if you can still get a projection that looks like this.
Yeah,
that's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what Tapu tried to do?
Is that what you tried to do, Tapu?
No, there I am, Fourier data, the reference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was more to assess the bias and the Fourier correlation, right? Yeah.
But the idea is basically mid-maps, but I implemented Fourier space. That's how we think.
I'm getting confused by this discussion, because if I omit a Fourier space and do a reconstruction, that reconstruction should not have anything there in that plane of Fourier space, and therefore that projection should show nothing. So
well, hold on.
It's not the same as
think of a tomogram that will, if you can tilt really from minus 90 to plus 90, you can reconstruct your particle entirely and then calculate a projection that is along the tilt axis, which you've never observed.
And we find this quite useful in tomography for realigning the data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's a very good idea. No, you can't. I mean, you can't. So our measure will not say anything about overall correctness or not. It can't. It, you know, it just looks at a, you know, how the noise behaves versus the what you call the density of your particle, and so, you know, in both cases you have density of your particle. And then the resolution in both cases is around 40 angstroms or so. Which is, you know, where our measure, as I said, has this problem. So,
Nico, if you have done 2D reference-free classification and alignment in this sample, that I've never seen where the process has never involved this particular reference frame, so independent of this, there's a view for there's this pseudo twofold symmetry that appears in one of your models. That if that model is correct,
we'll
have no representation in the data.
Yeah, but you see mainly this view and never this, and never the view that looks like this. So that's part of the problem.
There are views that are not present, hardly present in the
data. Yeah, or very rarely present, yeah. So that's part of the problem with this particular preparation. You know, you can prepare the spice zone differently, and encourage it to assume more different orientations, but in this particular case, that was one of the problems. Yeah.
Is another possibility for an omit map to leave a domain like the red domain off of your model and have it do alignment and see if the red domain comes back?
Yeah, it would be, I guess. How would you leave it off? Just set it to zero? Yeah, I mean, you could in principle, but you sort of have to decide how exactly you're masking it out without introducing other problems. I mean, what David said, I thought, is a really nice idea. All right, so I'll just skip ahead. Because we wanted to talk about heterogeneity. Okay, so this is another case that we worked on in the lab from a AAA-ATB NSF that is involved in vesicle recycling and synaptic terminals, and it's a collaboration with Axel Brunger. So it forms a hexamer, but has three different domains: N-domain. D1 and D2. D1 and D2 are homologous to each other, and D2 was actually crystallized. It forms a hexamer on its own. And then there's a crystal structure of the N domain. There are also crystal structures of alpha snap and snare that are binding to this hexamer, NSF hexamer, and then are being disassembled, presumably by some movement of the N domain that is driven by ATP hydrolysis. And so the N-domain is already expected to be flexible. This is just cryo, then the usual class averages, reprojections, and structures, which don't prove anything, I agree. Matching projections with the original particles that I'm not going to talk about now. But when you look at the real space variance, and that sort of was at the time a crude way of calculating this, just by calculating several reconstructions with a sixth of the data set each, you see that there's more variance in this up here, in this part of the structure, than down here. At the bottom of the structure, you can see that the X-ray structure corresponds quite well with the density, the EM density, so you see sort of little secondary structure elements in the yellow density that correspond with the X-ray structure. And at the time, it was difficult for us to decide how the second ring, that is just the same, we use the same structure as for the first ring, how that is oriented with respect to the first ring. Is it an arrangement like this, or is it an arrangement like this, for example, that you observe in a related AAA ATP, ASP, 97, and VCP? And one of the reasons why this was ambiguous is that this structure here becomes more washed out. And when you look at the N-domain, it is not obvious how that would fit in here because of the heterogeneity. Okay, so this is because I think one of the questions on my part was how to identify heterogeneity. That would be a sign where density is missing or doesn't resolve structural details as well as other parts of your structure. And so the heterogeneity produced an uncertainty in their interpretation. And so I want to get to the heterogeneity part a little more for Fred. So I just thought I should go over a few things that you can check off also. And I wanted to make sure that everybody understands this is, you know, detecting problems is not so easy. One thing is, does it look like a ball? And this is looks a little like half serious, but you know, if you get your angular assignments wrong, it will tend to look like a spherically averaged particle. And so that's something, if you get a reconstruction out that is very spherical, it could be actually the actual shape of your molecule, but it could also be an indication that you didn't get the angular assignments right. And so it's much better if your particle and your reconstruction are very asymmetric. Is it hollow? We talked about this. CTF correction. Does the reference match the particles? This is also something that Tom showed yesterday. Does it correlate with known structures? Obviously, X-ray, but also maybe other structures, EM structures that people have determined. That would be very useful. If you have to invoke a big conformational change to make it fit with something that was determined earlier, it is something that should raise a higher level of carefulness or so. You know, I mean, it doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just that you have to be more careful. Can the high-resolution details be verified somehow, for example, with an X-ray structure? Does it make sense? Often you can decide if the reconstruction makes sense or not by looking at the biology or comparing it in some fashion with the expected molecular mass. How does the structure refine? We talked about this briefly, you know, that, for example, you increase the resolution cutoff and the Fourier correlation goes up. Maybe an indication that at low resolution you don't have a very good correlation and therefore because your structure overall is not correct. And it's the heterogeneity, which adds an additional level of complexity. So different types of heterogeneity, just two slides before Fred starts. You know, I think you can distinguish between conformational heterogeneity and composition heterogeneity. So NSF alone, not bound to the snare complex, can be seen to have heterogeneity because in class averages you see sort of roughly hexameric views here, but little things that stick out in some places and not in other places around this hexamer. And so this, from what we know about the overall structure of NSF, is probably the N-domain that can assume different conformations. So this would be a conformational heterogeneity. Presumably all of these are hexamers of NSF, so the composition is constant. Composition heterogeneity, I just thought of an example here from our work where we looked at the potassium channel shaker and its binding partner, the speeder subunit. You can get these complexes just by mixing the two, but not all of them will form this complex. So in a field, you'll find some cases where you see the alpha and beta subunit bound to each other and others where you just see the alpha subunit. And this sort of thing you will get out of a classification. So that would be a case for compositional heterogeneity. Often these two types of heterogeneities come together, especially when a ligand binds and then invokes some conformational change. So, Fred.